FM 24/7 Radio Network, broadcasting from AM and FM stations around the country. Welcome to the Small Business Administration award-winning School for Startups Radio, where we talk all things small business and entrepreneurship. Now, here is your host, the guy that believes anyone can be a successful entrepreneur, because entrepreneurship is not about creativity, risk, or passion, Jim Beach.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another exciting edition of School for Startups Radio. We have a fantastic show for you today. I am so excited. You know that side gig that my family runs? We rent our swimming pool on an app called Swimply. Their CEO, Poonam Laskin, will be with us today to talk about how the app was born. And I can't wait to learn about it. It's a big part of our life here, and so we're excited to talk to him. After that, Jennifer Long is with us to tell us something that we may not want to hear. Our workers are the solution, not the problem. Ooh, that's going to be fun and maybe a little controversial. I think workers sometimes are such a pain in the ass. And so anyway, I can't wait to speak with Jennifer about that. It's a great show. We'll have a lot of fun, I promise. And thanks for being with us. We'll be right back to get started. Oh, remember, please go buy my book, The Real Environmentalist, on Amazon. You will love it.
Bye.
And no action on climate change? Introducing The Real Environmentalists, the bold new book by Jim Beach. It's not about activists, politicians, or professors. It's about the entrepreneurs, real risk takers, building cleaner, smarter solutions, not for applause, but for profit. The entrepreneurs in the book aren't giving speeches. They're in labs, factories, and offices, cleaning the past and building clean products for the future. The Real Environmentalists is available now, because the people saving the planet aren't the ones you think. Go to Amazon and search for Real Environmentalist. Thank you.
We are back, and again, thank you so very much for being with us. All you great, loyal listeners know that we have several gig businesses here on the side. One of them is that we rent our swimming pool. That's right. We have an amazing backyard with a 30-foot swinging bridge and a treehouse and a creek and a ravine and a huge swimming pool with the old-fashioned diving board and everything. We didn't really want a swimming pool, but when we saw this backyard, we decided we had to have it. And a couple years after that, we started renting the pool out on an app called Swimply, like Simply, but Swim, P-L-Y. And we've done very well with it. Love the app and love the gig business and the revenue that we've made. Anyway, the CEO and the founder of Swimply is here with us today. His name is Poonam Laskin. He is also a Forbes 30 Under 30 winner, and he is the CEO and founder of Swimply. Welcome to the show. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me.
Tell us the birth of the story. How did you get going? How did you have this idea?
Of course. So I'm the oldest of 12. So I have 9 younger sisters and 2 younger brothers. And in 2018, my mother had my 12th sibling, my youngest sister, and we never really had a pool or any means to send anyone to camp. So summer came around and kind of all of us were stuck at home. Our neighbor, she built the pool that year. And she figured if she let us use it once, we would move into her backyard. And she was definitely a very fair assessment on her end. So she was very careful about letting us use it. But one day I overheard her talking to my mother about how much it costs her to keep it up. And it's not being used all the time. And so I offered, hey, why don't we use your pool when it's empty, and in exchange, we'll help you with the expenses. And she was delighted by the idea. Before long, everybody noticed that the largest family in the block was being accommodated by this neighbor, and everyone approached her and offered her the same thing. And before you knew it, her pool went from something that was costing her money to something that was making her money. And I was determined to bring this solution to the rest of my city. So I started knocking on doors. I went on Google Earth to see who had pools and who didn't. I knocked on 80 doors to be exact. I got 4 people to agree to let me rent out their pool when they weren't using it. I put my phone number all around town. So there was no website. This is back in 2018. You called me. I called the owners back. I called you with the information. If the pool was available, I charged you over the phone and I delivered checks in person every other week. And it kind of just took off from there. I decided to drop out of school. I was studying abroad at the time. I raised $1 million and I launched Swimply in 2019. And here we are today. We're now in 150 cities. We're in 3 countries. And we have amazing hosts like you all over the place, providing joy to people in our community while making an incredible income on the side.
And so you raised the money before you even had a website, or did you finally get a site up right around in that same time?
No, I completely raised the money before there was a website. And actually, it actually helped not having a website, because I was able to show investors, like, look how terrible this user experience is. They have to call my cell phone number, then they have to wait there while I call other owners, and then I have to call you back, and you get no photos, you get no reviews, you get no information. And people were still booking. I think at that point I had like 400 completed bookings, just all hand-to-hand combat. And when you show investors, hey, look how terrible this experience is, and people still were having such an incredible time with it, it lend a lot of credibility to what this can become.
And so how did you meet the VC and get in there and get the introduction and all that? That's hard. How'd you do that?
So in the beginning, I didn't really know what VCs even were. To be honest, I didn't even know what investors were or what an engineer was. I grew up in a really orthodox community, and you're kind of designed from the start to become a rabbi. And so English education is not really the biggest priority, let alone learning about business. And so I kind of just had to start from scratch, figuring out what everything meant and how do I take this solution and make it scalable throughout the whole country. There's only so many phone calls I can answer in a day. And ultimately, my naiveness towards everything is what gave me just like an incredible sense of confidence. I just started literally pitching any adult to invest in this idea. And so I didn't really go to VCs at first. Initially, it was just anybody I could find out that had a nice house that I can get friends with, and assumed they had extra cash to invest in things. And so I raised my first $1 million from pitching 130 people and just collecting checks one at a time until I felt like I had enough in the bank to really get started.
That is amazing. I love it. So did you start building a website then?
So yes, I didn't want to start building anything until I had like the full million, because I wanted to give investors reassurance that I can have what it takes, not just to build a website, but also to market it. I raised $1 million. I started building the website in March of 2019, launched it in July of 2019. So in the middle of summer, I hired a team in Ukraine to build the first version before we brought it in-house. And so that's kind of how we originally took off. The first version of the website, also, mind you, was a slight upgrade for the website over the phone call. You saw photos this time and you saw reviews, but you still couldn't book through the site. You still had to call, but at least you saw everything that you needed. And then we started rolling out features one at a time. So we didn't wait till the website was perfect. We launched like what we called an MVP and put it out there. At least people can see photos and at least people can see availability. And so the phone call would be 13 seconds long instead of 5 minutes long. And then we just released, by the end of the summer, you could book through the platform and streamline the whole thing. Eventually we raised venture capital, and that's when we brought engineering in-house and really souped up the whole experience.
And he brought in a CEO as well, right?
So, funny enough, we brought in a CEO a year ago, around 2 years ago, to take over where I brought it to. And then I kind of came back this past year.
What happened? What was the problem with the Renta CEO?
So it was just that I raised, after that first summer in 2019, we raised another $10 million. Venture capital, and then we raised another $40 million a year later, and the company got to such a large place. And I was I was building this since I was 20, and I wanted to get married and kind of see the world, and I thought Swimply was in a really good place. Around this time was when Brian Chesky and Paul Graham were talking about founder mode and how you know, you need some companies need to be built by the founder for as long as possible. And that came out around like 2 months after I already left. We brought in the CEO to run the company, assuming the company was only a really good place. And I was going to kind of have a year hiatus. Over that year, it became a little obvious that when it comes to building something that is that's never been done before, that you it needs to be part of your heartbeat, essentially. Like, you have to have somebody who's like there from day one that like bleeds when the company bleeds, smiles when it does well, and doesn't when it doesn't. And all the decision just came down to like the we're still too innovative and still too many creative solutions need to come around to get a what you call a rent a CEO to run it. And so the decision was made that I would come back in and bring founder mode back versus manager mode. And we've been crushing it. So.
All right. How do you define crushing it in terms of revenue or number of pools that you represent? How do you, or markets? You've bragged so, I would in 125 say, markets. So normally people brag about revenue.
So for me, the vision was never about, I wouldn't say there was a dollar amount attached to the vision I had when I got really excited about this idea. To me, my family told us they use the Swimply Next Door. Using the Swimply Next Door. And the idea that every booking on Swimply represents a moment that people are having and an experience that's being created, that kind of to me was the adrenaline. And so we tend to brag about how many people use us and how widespread we've become, because that represents, I think, the amount of joy and the amount of just true like value add that we bring on. As far as when I say crushing it now, I mean experience. I think during my time away, a lot of the core ideas of the business were eroded a little bit. Customer support being first and foremost. Again, the first version of the app, it was all phone calls. Like every host and every guest spoke to somebody. And then a lot of that was we attempted to streamline a lot of that and make speaking to actual human beings much more difficult. And so we invested in great customer support and great experience. The app, a lot of it was just a lot of the core functions of the tech experience were neglected in exchange for new experiences. And so we really just came down to streamline everything, make every part of Swimply that was not incredible, and to get the company to a place of like extreme profitability. And so for us, that's kind of been my ethos since I came back, like, fix everything about Swimply that sucks, make it awesome and truly delightful, and make the company mature by bringing it to profitability and kind of getting off the whole growth at all cost mindset. So that's kind of what we mean by crushing it. Great experience and great returns.
And when you talk about growing now, are you trying to get more hosts, more customers? Which one of those is more important to you?
So it actually changes per city. And some cities are actually removing hosts. We're increasing the standards in some places. At first in a marketplace, it's kind of like anybody that can help grow the marketplace and anyone that will even bother trying is a win. But in some places where Swimply is really mature, there's a lot of hosts that hurt the quality and the reliability of the platform. So in some places, we're actually the only focus for us is quality. Like there's a tremendous amount of demand and a tremendous amount of supply, but there is not a ton of reliability. There's only so much Swimply can do often to make sure that the guest gets the experience that they want. That's part of the challenges of running a marketplace. So in some markets, we're just focusing on quality, making sure that the best hosts are moved to the front, that the worst hosts are eventually either coached into being great hosts or weeded out. And so that everybody can have a more ideal experience. In some markets, there's a lot more guests than there are hosts. And so we focus specifically on trying to onboard hosts. In almost no markets do we have a strong issue with guests, but there is sometimes more competition. And so a lot of hosts feel like they're getting less than the past just with the rise of competition and what people are looking for. And so those tend to be our two focuses, onboarding more hosts and quality.
Those are certainly what you need to focus on. That makes sense. And that's interesting that you're removing some hosts as well. I like to hear that. How do you get more guests? How do you grow the platform overall? What kind of marketing do you do?
Of course. So funny fact, we've raised a ton of money and we were able to spend a lot in marketing. To this day, majority of our growth, around 80%, comes word of mouth. And that seems to be really fascinating until like you really think about it. Like when somebody books a swim play, they bring friends almost all the time. It's very rare that there's a one person or even a two person swim play booking. And then when not only do they come and bring friends, when they're done, they'll tell people about their day. And in the modern day, they post about it on social media, about what they experienced. There's around 500 posts on social media a day promoting simply just organically. And so that's one of the real ROIs about being in the business of fun, is that people do it with each other and then people share share their fun with people that they love. And so that's, till this day, the biggest way that we grow. Another way that simply grows is that the hosts actually have a lot of power in their hands to market themselves. So unlike similar platforms, say Airbnb, you can't, if you're a host in Queens, New York, you can't really market to people in Taiwan that are coming to visit New York for the first time. But as a host in Georgia, you, a lot of your consumers are people in the area. So a lot of hosts do market themselves. It's kind of what we call internally host-led growth, where the hosts actually create social media pages and they promote themselves locally. And we developed a lot of tools for owners to also market themselves, almost like small businesses. Like we developed a tool for our hosts to have their own lifecycle feature. So they can actually send rewards and incentives to people that have booked their pool in the past to come back again. We even let them market to people that haven't booked their pool, but have only viewed their pool or favorited their pool. And we give our owners a way to further push them to get that. So that's kind of like how, that's how the majority of how we grow. Things that Swimply does is we used to spend a lot of money on performance ads. So Facebook and Instagram and Google. And what we found is that ads never really did the job, mainly because there's just so much to teach about Swimply, right? It's not like we're marketing a pair of pants or everybody knows what a pair of pants is and how it works. And you just got to market why it's better. With Swimply, we always need to tell people what we are, how this works. You'd be shocked how many people think that we deliver pools to their house or that we fix pools. And so you have to teach them it's like that. It's similar to Airbnb, but for pools. And then you have to demystify it. Obviously, even though we're in 2025, a lot of people still have a little bit of extra consideration when it comes to the sharing economy and going into a marketplace versus something standardized. And so ads, to have one ad also educate people, tell them how it works, and make it something that they feel safe and trust is very, very difficult. So where we tend to invest a lot of our marketing dollars is in PR. We get a lot of press kind of all the time. And a lot of our hosts are interviewed throughout the country, as well as influencers, because they're able to, in 2025, they're kind of the only people able to tell the story of Swimply, how to use it, their experiences, and kind of show the world that this is like a really magical way to democratize really cool assets. And so that's kind of how we, those are kind of our three things that we put in play.
I did a TV segment here in Atlanta for one of the local stations. They came by and I just did an interview for realtor.com about Swimply that hasn't aired yet, as far as I know, hasn't dropped yet. But you're right. A lot of the hosts do a lot of the marketing and do their own stuff. We have our own website and everything. How do you determine what hosts come up first on the listings?
So it's a little bit of a black box in the sense where like the algorithm. So we have an algorithm that its only objective is to show the guests what they want to see. And the only way it knows what they want to see is based on what guests are clicking on. And we can just reverse engineer why guests are clicking on certain listings over others. And like what seems to be the indicating factor for why the algorithm is promoting these pools versus not. So the sole purpose is that like if more people are clicking on pools that are purple, then purple pools are going to be promoted first versus other pools. And so what we found is that the things that matter the most to guests is great photography. That's like the number one by far biggest indicator that like guests will click on your pool. The second one being the number of 5-star reviews you have, especially in the sharing economy. That's something that's like vital for guests to build trust in a platform. And so I think you mentioned you have 217 5-star reviews. Is that correct?
219, damn it. Don't discount those last two.
sorry for the disrespect, however. But yeah, so that's like going to be by like the second by far biggest element. And then the third one is really just price. And price does not necessarily mean you're overpriced or underpriced. It just that like some hosts price very high because that's like what's worth their effort for that particular time. Some hosts price really low to get as many bookings as possible. They're trying to maximize every hour of the day. But we noticed that like hosts with a more conservative price, that tends to be the one of the larger indicators as well. So it really comes down to photography, reviews, and pricing. The other things the algorithm does factor in that has nothing to do with like how attractive your pool is just the host's like behavior on the platform. So if the host cancels on guests, after they booked, they may find themselves getting penalized by the algorithm. If the host declines or guests seemingly without proper cause, then that hurts them. So the algorithm does factor in also just really reliable hosts versus not. But from the consumer perspective, those are really the big three, like photos, reviews, and price.
And what is Atlanta? A host market or a market where you're still trying to grow users or hosts? You were explaining that earlier. Which one is Atlanta?
So most of our top 10 markets, and Atlanta's top 10, I think it's number 8 right now. We are focusing on quality more than we're focusing on expanding the market. And so Atlanta right now, we are working, and every market, the standard needs to be really custom. And so based on like what the average behavior is there. And so Atlanta right now is one of our projects to actually just reduce the amount of hosts. And so the best hosts consolidate the experiences.
I would feel like that's the right idea. That's my feeling as well.
From the ground, you're reporting from the ground in Atlanta.
Yes, that yes, you know that we hear that there are some pools that are just not that their photographs don't represent the way that the site looks. And that's the number one comment we get when people walk in our gate. Oh my God, it looks just like the pictures. And that's something I don't understand because I don't know how you could fake it to not look like the pictures. You know what I mean by that?
Yeah. I mean, creative angles can get you very far. Get a pool's good side.
You know, we have 10 pictures there, maybe 12 or something. After that, you know what the site looks like, I would hope.
So. Yeah, I mean, so that's another big one. It's not just about how good the photos are, but it's also how well the photos capture the space. A lot of people have like 10 photos of just the water. When the truth is, the reason why people love their backyards, especially if there's a pool in there, is not just the water, but also the hangout around it and the overall environment in the space. And so often it's not just about the quantity in photos, it's also quality. You get both done right,
then
you're in a really good place.
Pull me up.
Yeah, actually, let me see if I can find you. Boom.
30328 is our zip code. So while he's looking for that, I'll tell you, listeners, we have worked very hard on our photos. I even got on the roof to take some of them.
Of their backyards, especially if there's a pool in there, it's not just the water, but also the hangout around it and the overall environment in the space. And so often it's not just about the quantity in photos, it's also quality. You get both done right, then you're in a really good place.
Pull me up.
Yeah, actually, let me see if I can find you. Boom.
30328 is our zip code. So while he's looking for that, I'll tell you, listeners, we have worked very hard on our photos. I even got on the roof to take some of them.
I just found it. Amazing. 219 five-star reviews. Incredible photography. Really captured. You have a lot of like, you have almost, it sounds like you also have a lot of like decorations that you set up for a lot of these photos, capturing a lot of moments and showing them what they could be. I see that you've also put on your TV appearance on there. Brilliant. Absolutely brilliant. I would say this is a 10 out of 10 execution. See the treehouse. I see the Valentine's champagne, red roses, poolside
champagne
experience.
Yep.
Yeah. And then I see
that is, we guarantee that it turns a second date into a third date.
Well, there you go. That's amazing. And then I see also you have like this really cool, like mermaid photography.
That's my daughter in our pool. Our pool has been used for several, all of these pictures were taken in our pool. And then there's a picture there. Do you see the movie crew standing next to the pool?
Yes, I do.
That's the death of one of the characters in Walking Dead. One of the characters sinks to death.
Yeah.
And that, that we actually domed the pool one year, put a dome over the entire backyard, and they rented it to film that actor sinking to his death. And that was
no way. That is
that was part of our so Walking cool. Dead.
That is so cool. Did you watch the show?
No, I'd never seen the show. No.
Oh, you got it. You got it.
We also have a famous mermaid photographer who is the official photographer for Burning Man. And he lives here in Atlanta and he does mermaid stuff. So he's gotten my little daughter into it, but he also took, there's an Atlanta band called Yacht Rock. And they're a big band nationally and stuff. They tour nationally. But they're in very much a niche. They play 80s and 90s cover tunes and do it well enough to fill up arenas, but they just did their album cover in our pool as well. So,
well, there you go. I mean, every day I think I learn about new use cases that happened. It was originally designed for families like my own. And families still represent, I think, like 50 to 60% of all buggings. And it was like 100% families for like the first 2 years. And then now you kind of see it branching out to anything from events and celebrations to photo shoots. I even know there's a mermaid meetup that goes on the app every week.
Yes.
In different places in the country, there's like these mermaid meetups. So you learn really new things every day.
Yes.
Even from your own app.
We've had a big summer of dogs as well. You know, we're dog friendly and not many people are. And so our dog business has exploded. And you know what else has exploded for us? Is Instagram shoots and OnlyFans shoots.
Oh, okay. Yeah, different third right there. Dogs have been a huge one. I don't know if you saw, we launched a pet park category.
I did not.
On the app.
Oh.
So yeah, so there is, that could be why you're now seeing a lot more dogs. Over the last 12 months, people wanting to take their dog on a swim has skyrocketed 700%.
And we're half of that.
So there you go. Well, now we know where it's coming from. Yes. Well, there you go. So we just pretty much created a category just for you, Jim, and it's really you're welcome. And we are just seeing 93 million homes in America have a dog, and they often dog owners treat their dogs like family. And so, in the same spirit of families being what the app was built for, we ultimately expanded the nature of swim play to also dogs. So now there's like a pool category, there's like pickleball category, and there's a pet park category. And the pet parks are just pools that love dogs.
Yep.
And they're private and they're dog friendly. And so we just made it 100 times easier. So that could be maybe one of the reasons you're seeing it, but you also could be one of the reasons we built it.
Yep. So Airbnb is having a really bad year.
You know, sure.
They are out of style right now. What are your thoughts on that?
I mean, there is, I think there's like a level of, as you grow to their size, I think there's almost like, it's very difficult to do right by everybody. And so I think a lot of what they're doing often has a lot of fans. And I think a lot of people do love Airbnb. I personally love Airbnb. I've been, actually spent the last year on Airbnb. I think that the problem is that often happiness and people being content are very silent, and the people that are not happy are really loud and really vocal. And we've seen that in Swimply. We'll roll out something for our hosts that 90% like and love and 10% don't. And so, and we'll see that turning into a very loud, like, point of conversation that we do our best to address. And so it's hard to know whether they're unpopular because their policies are truly bad for the marketplace, or if you just can't, when you have, you know, millions of users, there's going to be a strong percentage that aren't happy with almost anything you do. And if they're the loudest. So I do know that the founders of Airbnb, and I know that they're extremely passionate about what they're building. It's hard to, I think, be, the larger you get, the harder it is, I think, to be popular. The newer you are, the easier it is to be popular. And so that's a friction, I think, that they're dealing with right now.
Well, I mean, it's certainly out of style now. And, you know, they do have a lot of cities really mad at them. So it's going to be interesting to see how it plays out. And
what are your thoughts on non-Airbnb and the friction that they're seeing, like at first glance?
Say again, what exactly is your question?
What are your thoughts on the Airbnb as a Swimply host? Like, what are your thoughts on the pushback that Airbnb is getting?
Well, it does concern me because in our city, we have to get the Airbnb license to operate as a Swimply. And so that affects us. I see that they've done a lot of harm to big cities, to hotel rentals and to apartments, and the number of people trying to rent those same properties for, you know, long-term rental as opposed to short-term. There are so many people who bought properties who are now trying to, you know, desperately ditch them because they can't afford it because it's not Airbnb being enough. You know, they're not renting it enough. And so I look at the, you know, the comparisons to Swimply on a daily basis and think about it every day. I don't think that Airbnb, I think they should have stopped in some cities before they, you know, keep going. I think it should be harder to get an Airbnb up now, by, you know, onto the site, not in the city. I think their standards, have slipped, and it's hard to justify. You know, the thing I think is the hardest is the cleaning fees. You've, you know, $400 cleaning fees for some place that you spend $110 on a night, you know, I think the cleaning fees is where, and you have to clean the place yourself. You get doinged, you know, you get a bad review if you don't take the trash out yourself, but then I'm paying a $400 right. cleaning fee. You know, shouldn't that cover the trash being taken out? So I think that Airbnb has got, a problem with their own standards. They haven't decided how to do it right yet.
You know? So I'll tell you, when we look at this and we, well, we're involved in a lot of the places where Airbnb is questioned, because obviously we have certain interests in ensuring that Swimply House can continue going. And what we found is that, like, a lot of the, you know, the consequences, you would say, of Airbnb blowing up are actually the quite the antithesis of when Swimply grows, mainly being that Swimply is for the locals, right? Like, when Swimply opens up in the city, now all the locals get access to a really beautiful recreational activity, right? Like, Swimply is one of the few apps that actually makes you put your phone away and swim and be with people that you love. And this is actually a really healthy activity emotionally, spiritually, and physically. And so when Swimply opens up in the city, the locals get access to something beautiful, and the locals get additional revenue that then goes back into the locals. I think you don't necessarily see that with Airbnb, because
the locals are the ones. Airbnb.
It's the exact opposite, right? And then Airbnb, opposite. it's the locals paying the price for it. And so we haven't seen
another thing that I think is really important is, sorry to interrupt, running out of time, is the racial component too. I feel very, very good about our rental with Swimply, because a huge portion of our clients are minorities who couldn't get into a club or don't have access to as beautiful a property as we're providing. And a huge percentage of our clients are minorities, and we like that. And I feel like that's one of the coolest things we're doing, is providing access to people who couldn't get anything close to this.
Yeah, you would actually be shocked overall in the app how much minorities are overrepresented. Right. And it has to do directly with, I think, what you're saying, that they're coming from places where we're underserved. And now you're having both the communities with pools and without pools coming together and, like, really evening out the playing field in a really beautiful way. And so I think that when you see Swimply open up in a city, you just see a lot of really incredible things happen. You see communities coming together, people from each other's neighborhoods they would not have crossed paths come together, owners making money, guests getting access to a really beautiful recreational activity. And so I think that a lot of the friction you see with Airbnb is a natural consequence of what they're doing. A lot of what you see with Swimply, I think, is just really leveling up the city overall in a really beautiful way.
How do we find out more? Follow you online, get in touch, become a pool host, rent a pool, come to your house for dinner, all of those things.
Yes, Swimply app, swimply.com. And we're, I think, right now number 80 in the App Store. And so I'm working our way up there. And if you're looking for an incredible pool, Jim's on the platform. It's available by that. He's available by the hour.
Yes. And we love renting. So, you know, another cool thing about it is that our kids are involved. And our kids have been told that if you want tennis lesson, go clean the pool, get it ready for a guest.
There you go.
And then we get the whole family involved. Greet the guest and get practice at, you know, going and saying hello to somebody and thank you for coming and stuff. So our kids are all in on the business, which I think is another cool aspect as well.
Beautiful. Yeah. And a way to get them to even see it in action, get some responsibility in their, on their shoulders at a young age. Amazing.
Congratulations on what you've done. Amazing success. I love being a tiny, 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 tiny part of it. And we'd love to have you back as the company grows. Thank you so much and congratulations.
Thank you so much. Congratulations to you, Jim.
And we'll be right back.
Tired of talk and no action on climate change? Introducing The Real Environmentalists, the bold new book by Jim Beach. It's not about activists, politicians, or professors. It's about the entrepreneurs, real risk takers, building cleaner, smarter solutions, not for applause, but for profit. The entrepreneurs in the book aren't giving speeches. They're in labs, factories, and offices, cleaning the past and building clean products for the future. The Real Environmentalists is available now because the people saving the planet aren't the ones you think. Go to Amazon and search for Real Environmentalists. Thank you.
We are back, and I am very excited to make my next guest cry. Her name is Jennifer Long, and she is going to try her hardest not to cry. It's a little game she and I are playing. I'm very excited to talk to her. We have just been talking about kids and kids getting jobs and growing up and all of that, and so I think we're going to have fun. Jennifer, Jen, as she prefers, is a master coach and president of Own Up, where she works with corporate managers, teams, and leaders to make them perform better and think more strategically. She has a book of that name as well, Own Up, How to Hold People Accountable Without All of the Drama, and has a new book just recently out called Workers Are the Solution, Not the Problem. She has a podcast of her own called Leadership Kung Fu. Jen, welcome to the show. How are you doing?
I am doing great, Jim. I'm happy to be here and speak to all the folks who are trying to build something without losing their mind. I can relate. And I'm excited to talk about some good strategies about accountability without all the stress. No crying.
All right. Well, tell us about the worst thing that ever happened to you. Let's start there.
The worst thing that ever happened.
I'm teasing. I was just going back to the crying joke. Are we in an age of accountability lessness? I don't feel like we're accountable anymore.
We're in an age of shamelessness. And so, yeah, personal responsibility is taking a hit dramatically. And I think people, you know, there's a lot of running and hiding. There's a lot of finger pointing and a lot of not me, it's them. And if it is me, but what about them kind of behavior?
Is it worse in the younger generations, our 20, 25-year-olds, 30-year-olds?
I think our 30-year-olds are looking for a better model. I think they're feeling really disillusioned, and they know it doesn't work, and they know it's not what you want. And we all, I mean, accountability is an expectation when we get together to do stuff, and it's really hard when you're consistently let down.
Let down by what?
Let down by people who don't, who make bad choices. And don't think through how to do it better. Don't take responsibility, because accountability is all about, the outcome is about responsibility and being clear about what you're responsible for. And I think we're in a world where that can get very muddy very quickly.
Well, that's true. Very true. So my very first business was a summer camp business. We had thousands of little snotty kids running around, and even worse, 18, 19-year-old, 20-year-old counselors, and us adults used to stand around and go, boy, this would be a great business if we didn't have employees or campers to deal with.
Right?
And I was just writing down, this is so weird, I was writing down my notes. I wrote Jennifer Long, and then I have a place where I write the topic, and I wrote, workers are problem. And I'm like, damn it, that's the exact opposite of what she's saying. That's my bias, my Freudian pen slip, wrote down what I actually believe versus what your book is.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, the workers are the solution is really helping leaders who are super frustrated about the kind of workers that are showing up. They've got a bias about how unprepared they are. And that's for a lot of reasons, right? Colleges aren't delivering. People don't have the kind of training. Companies really aren't spending on developing people. And it's really asking the question to leaders to say, look, this is the workforce you've been dealt. Learn to lead it. And getting upset about what they're ready or not ready for isn't going to help you in your business. You've got to figure out, if this is the group of folks I'm going to get, they're willing. Are you willing to meet them where they are and lead them better?
But their willingness is on their
terms.
Yes.
First time you're up against a generation who feels entitled to tell you how they think about it, how they feel about it, and what they're really looking for. And they want a more meaningful experience and work than any generation. And while I think there's a backlash of, we're going to tell you to come back to work and do it our way and pay what we feel like, the workforce is like, yeah, maybe, but I don't feel compelled. And so I don't think it's a problem that's going away. And I do feel that if you're going to be successful, your ability to connect to this workforce, where they are, how they see the world, what they're looking for, and how you can work together is going to be a better solution than trying to pull them through a 100-year-old model around what work is.
All right. Very interesting solution. So how do I change then? What do I need to do to accept that workers are the problem? I mean, solution. Damn it. I still can't say it.
Workers are your workforce is the solution, not the problem. The people closest to the work are going to be the people who help you innovate the most, because they're the ones who are in it and they understand what their challenges are. And they're willing to share their perspective and help you problem solve how to move your business forward. And the further you are away from the actual work, the less information you have about what's going on. And just because you've done it once, right? And as people who have been in the have started the stuff and know the stuff and feel like they have an answer, you've brought these people in, you've picked these people for a reason. How do you work together to create the opportunity? And so some of that is creating space for conversation, creating space for listening to what they have to say, and also creating an environment that makes sense for both of you to get stuff done. And innovating ways through that is how it's going to work. And AI has created giant opportunities there. And you've got a digital workforce that can leverage that quicker than a lot of people with experience and expertise.
So in the book, you have courses of action, 7 things that we can do. Can we quickly go through some of those? Number one, look outside your organization.
Yeah. So looking outside your organization is has to do with learning agility, which is one of the biggest leadership advantages. Like when you look for people who are good leaders, their ability to leverage information outside their own industry, leverage information outside their own business, look at what other trends. And so a good example of that is, do you read? Right? Do you read other books that really don't have to do with what you are? Otherwise, you get stuck in your own silo and believe your own thinking, right? We get in these conversation bubbles and we're all having groupthink. And I just read a great book. Let me promote someone else's book while I'm on here, called Techno-Feudalism, which is about the end of capitalism. And it's really a good sense-making book about the business environment we're actually really in. That kind of stuff is going to help you get better information to make decisions as a business person. So getting outside makes good sense.
Number 2, create more meaningful connection.
Right? Know your people, especially if you're in the entrepreneurial size business. It's a small team. And it's not just when their birthday is and how many kids they have. It's when we look to develop people, it's not just what skills do I need you to have to work in my business? Who do they want to be? What are their ambitions? How are you really having better, more meaningful conversations around who they are, what they see, and where they want to go, and how you can leverage that to work together, because sometimes you train them up and they leave. And sometimes the ambition around your own business is going to surprise you. And taking the time to be intentionally developmental and connecting with people is a really good thing.
I haven't told this story in a while, so I'll tell this. It's one of my favorite stories. My office for that business I was talking about earlier, the summer camp business, we grew to 650 employees and had 89 locations and had the world's coolest home office. It was two levels. And I, of course, had an office upstairs, you know, because I was the boss. And it just so happened that directly below my office door, there, you know, the balcony, there was the comptroller sat right there. And at this time, I was having some Guillain-Barré. I was waking up paralyzed and stuff like that. And so I was having a lot of trouble walking and having to look down all the time so I didn't trip. And the comptroller came and quit one day, completely out of the blue. And I was just so shocked. I had no idea. Kind of upset. And 3 or 4 years later, I ran into him at the mall. And I asked, dude, why did you quit? We liked you. And he was like, because you were always staring at me, Jim. I was like, what are you talking about? He's like, every time you came out of your office, you were staring directly at me. I was like, dude, I wasn't trying to trip. It was because I had Guillain-Barré. I was trying not to trip.
Miscommunication. Uncertainty. Do I really know you? No, I don't. Yeah.
Number three, processes and systems for that connection.
Right. So here's a big one, because context drives behavior, and the systems you set up will deliver the behaviors that you get. So really be intentional about what, if you're not connecting, if you're having performance issues, what is it about your processes and systems that are actually working against you? And usually we go to behavior and we want to just legislate behavior. And we all know, because who hasn't had a speeding ticket, how well legislating behavior goes. So think about the systems that are set up and start to design those for the kind of connections you need.
Can you give me an example there? Are we talking about a foosball tournament on Friday?
Well, I think those are the easy answers, right? The how do we set up the rituals about how we connect, but also think about your performance management system, right? How is that set up? And I think a lot of people have put in, we overuse technology when we should be having face-to-face conversations. And when we have forced feedback through, you know, when was the last time you gave so-and-so feedback? Here, put it in here and I'll send them an email. And the email is not a conversation. The email is a transfer of information. And so that's a perfect system where we've offloaded an opportunity to connect to a platform and degrade the experience and don't have real conversations about, what we need to do better and what we want to do going forward.
Slow your roll. Number four.
Slow your roll. We're all working at speed and under pressure. And this environment is so uncertain in the business world. And so slow your roll is very much about stand outside your problems a little bit longer, create space to make connection. When you're overbooked, double booked, three meetings, you know, stacked on top of each other, your work is in control of you, and you just don't make good decisions. You're not present, and you don't do the work before the meeting.
Number five, problems are dynamic.
Problems are dynamic. This goes to what you're measuring, right? That people are looking at their metrics. Are we successful? Are we doing all the right things? And we look at these metrics and we keep these metrics because we think they are going to give us the information we need to make good decisions going forward. And that might be true for a period of time, but because your problems are dynamic, how you measure and how you think about them should also be dynamic. Just like your strategy, maybe that's a 3 to 5 year thing, but that your plans are going to change every quarter based on the environment. So your ability to pivot, that is married right up to slow your roll. Are you taking the time to stand outside and think about it before you move forward? Or are you not considering how things have changed and are you measuring the wrong things?
Number six, don't outsource your thinking.
This is a big one, not so much for the entrepreneurial set, but definitely for the big boys who bring in a lot of outside consultants to do the work. This is where, when we think the easy answer is to bring in people who have experience doing something, when what we're doing is we're selling ourselves short on a real practice around systems thinking, critical thinking, and problem solving, which when you start to get a good tool set around that, your strategies get stronger and your plans get stronger. And it's just better business practice to understand that people want meaningful work, and problem solving is some of the most meaningful work everybody does.
And finally, number seven, focus on choices and outcomes, not behaviors.
Right. This goes back to the behaviors.
Love the kid, hate the behavior.
Yeah. Yeah. Do a lot of work on accountability, which is, it's never about the result. It's never about the outcome. It's what are the decisions that drove the outcome? And when you knew that was going to happen, what did you choose to do? What would have been a better choice? Focus on the choices, not the outcomes.
Ooh, that's so hard to do. That's a challenging one.
But that takes a minute to think, right? I can yell at you about the crappy thing that just happened, or I can say, talk to me about when you made the decision to do whatever, right? Like that drove that outcome. What were you thinking? Well, what could you have done differently? Because taking the time to have that conversation, A, you learn how people think. B, you understand where their issues really are. And so then you can actually build solutions that are meaningful, other than just don't do that.
Makes a lot of sense. Tell us about your podcast.
Podcast. So I do a monthly podcast called Leadership Kung Fu with a co-host, Sandy Varecchia, who's also an executive coach and a trainer, and she's out of Toronto. And so we just sort of have the bold talk that around issues that we come across all the time in organizations, stuff you get when you coach executives and leaders and business folks, their struggles, all the inside skinny, inside baseball on coaching, and kind of the, you know, no nonsense approach to here's how you might address some of this stuff.
Excellent. I love it. Jennifer, yeah. Great information. And I do love your books and the idea that I am the problem. Damn you. And I love the idea of owning up. I really do. I think that that's the number one thing our society is missing right now. People who will say, "Ooh, I made a mistake. Let me apologize in public, please." So
yes,
we don't yes. have enough of that right now.
Well, I ownership is a place pain. It's a place of personal power. And a lot of people have just given, they think they're powerful by blaming other people, and what they're doing is just showing us, they'd like to abdicate their own authority by giving it to somebody else.
How do we find out more? Follow you online, follow you online and get in touch online.
Yeah. How do you find that? So if you want to find more works and tools and insights, you can find that at accountabilityatwork.com. As you know, you can listen to my podcast, Leadership Kung Fu, or you can get a free chapter of my book on accountability at jennifertlong.com. And that's how you can find me and follow me, or find me on LinkedIn, Jennifer T. Long. Yep.
Jen, thank you so much for being with us. Great stuff. And congratulations on another great book. Love to have you back.
Thanks, Jim.
We are out of time for today, but back tomorrow. Be safe, take care, and go make $1 million. Bye now.